The following episode may contain inappropriate material. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, world. This is Trish Adora, your Pan-African World Diaspora Champion, and you are listening to John Orlando on the PVDcast.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another installment of the PVDcast. I am your humble host and your podcast purveyor, John Orlando, and welcome to episode number 272. I hope you're doing well out there, and I thank you for checking out this episode. And you know, I thought about adding another moniker to my name for this introduction. Not only am I the humble host and the podcast purveyor, but I'm also a huge mark for world-class championship wrestling. That's right, longtime listeners of the PVDcast know my favorite wrestling promotion, probably of all time, is WCCW. And on this episode, I'm sitting down with a gentleman who wrote a screenplay about the Von Erich family. And that gentleman's name is Steve Goldstein. Now, I must confess, we talked a few months ago. So, as you're going to hear, there's probably going to be some comments about stuff going on in society that might be a little bit dated. And, you know, I do want to take this time to apologize publicly to Steve for taking forever to get this episode done. But I had so many in the can and so many waiting to be released. And sometimes, as a podcaster, you have guests that have time-sensitive material that has to come out. And so I got a little bit disorganized with the release of some of my episodes. So I do apologize to Steve. He's a really good dude. He's got a lot of opinions about the world of professional wrestling and other topics. He's got some weird and wild tales too, especially about the evolution of the screenplay, the initial steps to try to get it into production. And I'm just telling you, it's kind of mind-blowing when you hear these tales about this Von Erich movie that Steve put his heart and soul into writing. But before we get to my conversation with Steve, I want to let you know about the great sponsor of the PVDcast, World's Greatest Comics. The store is located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio. They have tons of comics from every era. They also have graphic novels, toys, comic book supplies, collectibles, posters, back issues. Basically anything you need for your fandom, they have. So stop on over to the store and say hi to Jeff and the fine folks at World's Greatest if you're in the Central Ohio area. If you're not, you can check them out online. Their website is wgcomics.com, and they're even on Facebook. Just look for at @WGComics. All right, with that out of the way, I'm going to throw it to a quick break, and on the other side of the break, I sit down with Steve Goldstein to talk about his screenplay about the Von Erich family. All right, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another installment of the PVDcast. I am sitting down this afternoon with a writer, a screenwriter, an educator, Steve Goldstein. Steve, how you doing, man?
I'm doing well, John. How are you, brother?
I'm doing okay. How are things up in Boston?
Pretty good. We're surviving the snow, and things are warming up a little bit, and staying COVID-free and waiting for the vaccine like the rest of the country.
You know, I spoke to somebody, an emergency room doctor, no doubt, who was in Boston, I want to say in April, and, getting firsthand details of how things were going up there. It was very eye-opening and very insightful. But, yeah. Hey, it's the best you can do is just stay safe and healthy till you get a shot at that vaccine.
It's a virtual world until then.
Exactly. Well, let's start off by talking about your screenwriting career. First of all, how did you get involved in screenwriting? Were you kind of like a creative kid growing up, or
How'd you manage to get into that field?
Okay, that's a good question. Yeah, I was always a creative kid. I was always writing stories, and I grew up in Boston, in Randolph, Massachusetts, which is in the suburbs outside. And I ended up at Brandeis, which is in Waltham, Massachusetts. And I was an English major, theater arts, always doing creative writing. And then when I was 20, I applied to film school, USC Film School, which was the number one film school at the time, still is. And I got in. We all wanted to follow George Lucas out to California. So I ended up in Los Angeles. And I was there for most of my life, actually. And 4 years ago, I ended up, when I got involved with the wacky world of professional wrestling, I ended up in Tulsa, Oklahoma 4 years ago. And I was on my way, I was going to move back east for a while. And I had a good wrestling friend out there, Steve Cox, used to wrestle with the Von Erichs. And we thought we had a Netflix project that fell through. And I ended up teaching high school for a year in Tulsa, and then I made my way back to Boston, which is where I am now. But eventually I will make my way back to L.A., but California is really bad right now in terms of the pandemic. Massachusetts is pretty safe, relatively speaking, so I'm staying put right now until things quiet down and we see what happens.
I'm just going to say that there is a name that I haven't heard of in quite a while. You just mentioned Steve Cox. I remember him as a world-class tag team champion.
Yes, he was actually with Michael P.S. Hayes. He was kind of an unofficial Freebird. Steve is a very good friend of mine, and I found him on Facebook, a long time ago. He didn't have a profile pic. But I remembered the name, and he used to wrestle with the mullet. And Steve, he wasn't a superstar, but he did win his titles with Michael P.S. Hayes. And he ended up in Fritz Von Erich gave him his start in World Class Championship Wrestling, WCCW. And then WF, which was Bill Watts' organization, poached a lot of people when World Class started going under. And I found him one day on Facebook. Steve and I call him my redneck brother from another mother. We got the same first and middle names. We have different politics, but we just hit it off. But yeah, anyways, Steve and I turned out to be good friends. And I brought him into the Von Erich Project because he wrestled with them. And his job, in addition to wrestling, was kind of keeping an eye on Kerry Von Erich, because Kerry used to get into some interesting situations. And Steve had a decent career. He finished out his career in Japan for the last couple of years. And he's in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And he did promoting for a while. But promoting when you don't have a TV contract is really tough. So, that's why I watch some of the wrestling programs. You need a TV contract to go anywhere, get some storylines going, turn it into a soap opera. But he's a good guy, and he was there when I needed him. And, we've been tight since all that happened. I'm glad you remember Steve. A lot of people remember him. And, he had a good career.
Yeah, well, you know what? I'm going to jump ahead. I want to ask some other questions about screenwriting, but let's jump ahead and let's talk about it, because I am a huge World Class mark. There was something about it as a kid that I just gravitated towards. I mean, I gravitated towards all pro wrestling, but Steve, I really gravitated towards World Class, because to me, you never knew what you were going to get when you tuned in to World Class Championship Wrestling, because there was an air of like chaos and unpredictability that I liked as a kid.
World Class was an excellent organization. When they got their syndicated contract with ESPN in the 80s, that's when they really began to take off. They were, they were national, and they were given the big three at the time. There is no more big three anymore, but at the time when you had the WWF, NWA, and AWA, American Wrestling Association, WCCW, World Class was giving, they left the NWA, they were part of the NWA, to begin with, and Fritz was really pushing to turn it into a big four. The TV program was ahead of its time. They were the first wrestling organization really to incorporate music opening theme music into their shows. And they had a very, it wasn't just the Von Erichs. Yeah, the Von Erichs were the drawing card, and it was a big family. But they have what I used to call the non-Erichs, Bruiser Brody, Chris Adams, Gino Hernandez, Iceman King Parsons. They had great storylines. But then things started turning sour in 1984 when David Von Erich died on a tour of Japan. David was being groomed to be the next NWA World Heavyweight Champion. He was going to take the title from Ric Flair. And, he was trading the Missouri State title back and forth with Harley Race at the time, which is usually the Missouri State title was a stepping stone to the NWA World Heavyweight Championship. You know, David was an interesting guy. He was redhead, 6'7". He was the tallest Von Erich brother. And he was very good in the ring, had a lot of skills. And he was the closest to Fritz. He liked to book. He was a booker. And in addition to wrestling, he had a real head for the business. So he was responsible for a lot of the great storylines. But then on that tour of Japan, he died. And, you know, they say it was a parasitic infection, but it might have been drugs, although, you know, everybody's sticking with the parasitic infection. But 1984 that was actually the beginning of the end of world-class championship wrestling. They hung around another maybe till 88, 89. But without David, they did push Kerry. Kerry did win the title for 3 weeks from Ric Flair, the NWA World Heavyweight Championship. But Kerry, who was a nice guy, give you the shirt off his back, he really wasn't reliable. And to be the world champion, you got to wrestle 6, sometimes 7 nights a week. You got to show up on time. And Kerry wasn't that kind of a guy. So he did drop the title back to Ric Flair, you know, 3 weeks later. And, the Von Erich history went in a different direction. There were more deaths, suicides. And, it's a tragic story. And that's where I got involved in writing a screenplay on the family.
I'm going to ask for your opinion on what is a controversial subject. Okay. And that is Mike Von Erich. There's many, many reports, if you want to call them that, or stories or folklore or whatnot, that Mike really wasn't into wrestling, but Fritz kind of forced his hand a little bit. And that may have led to some of the issues with Mike and obviously his injuries and then, of course, his mental health issues. What's your opinion on Mike Von Erich?
On Mike Von Erich, well, okay, you had Fritz was a champion. He had the AWA regional title, so you know he came from a long line. And the three champion brothers were David, Kerry, and Kevin Von Erich, who's the only survivor of the original Von Erichs now. And Mike, yeah, he was pushed in. I remember his. Mike wasn't, now Kevin swears that Mike had as much talent as everybody because when I've talked to Kevin, but I don't, he's his brother and I don't know if he's the most unbiased source. Mike's first big match was on television. It was a 10-minute draw with Ric Flair. That was probably more than he should have been put into at the time. And Mike never really, it was a lot to live up to. And it even followed the youngest brother, Chris Von Erich. I hate to use the phrase run to the litter, but, Chris was only about 5'7". But, yeah, Mike had a lot of pressure on him. And I believe Fritz pushed his sons. Kevin denies that. But, again, he's not the most unbiased guy in the world when it comes to talking about his father. And, yeah, I believe Mike was pushed too quick when he wasn't really ready. And that 10-minute draw with Ric Flair, yeah, that was probably more than he should have had at the time. And then he was on a tour in Israel, Mike, with the family, and he developed toxic shock syndrome, which is unusual for a guy to get it. And I actually know the doctor and his wife. Helen Horowitz Sooker is the wife. Dr. Sooker, Billy Sooker is her husband. He treated Mike, and Mike was never the same after that episode in Israel. He did have his drug and alcohol problems. Some drunken driving accidents, and he was the first of the three suicides in the family. So yeah, I really believe he was pushed too fast, too hard, and he wasn't up to it. He was a little smaller than Kevin, Kerry, and David. And, you know, I watched him. He didn't have a lot of mic skills, but they gave him some chance, some championships, some tag teams, six-man tag teams. But, yeah, I agree he was pushed too fast, too hard.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the screenplay that you wrote about the Von Erich family. What were the initial steps? Like, you obviously sat down and you said Steve Cox helped you out with this.
Well, actually, it goes before Steve Cox.
Okay.
There was a woman at the time, Lisa Renee Andrews. And sometimes that rings a bell with some people. Sometimes it doesn't. Lisa got a hold of me on Facebook. I didn't even know who she was. You know, we have a lot of mutual friends, da-da-da-da. And Facebook is a double-edged sword. You make some good contacts, but you know, until you meet somebody face-to-face, I'm an East Coast guy at heart, till you look somebody in the eye, shake their hand, break bread, you don't really know who you're dealing with there. And Lisa was from her background was publicity and music. And she saw me on a Facebook thread. And, you know, and for all these Von Erich fans kind of live in the past, you know, kind of like Deadhead people, the Grateful Dead, follow them everywhere. And, you know, they'll get on there and they'll say, Kevin's dead, rest in peace. And I got on one time on a thread that Lisa was on there and I corrected whoever the guy was. And I said, you know, Kevin's not dead. He's living in Hawaii, married his high school sweetheart, Pam. He's got four children, two boys that are in the wrestling business, Ross and Marshall. And, you know, don't say he's dead. I mean, it's almost like they want the curse to be completed, that all the Von Erichs are dead. And, you know, it's kind of weird. So anyways, Lisa, she thought I was another Steve Goldstein, to tell you the truth, which is funny. Steve Goldstein is like the Jewish John Smith. My generation, a lot of Goldsteins name their kids Stephen, Michael, or Paul. So I get mistaken for other Stephen Goldsteins. My name is spelled with a PH, but I go by Steve. You know, so she said, you're not the Stephen Goldstein who's related to Jonathan Goldstein. And there were actually two Jonathan Goldsteins. One of them was involved with producing Horrible Bosses, and the other one was kind of a shady guy. And, you know, so I said, no, I'm not that Steve Goldstein. I'm not related to Jonathan Goldstein. You know, after we went through the whole Goldstein mishmash, she said, well, you seem to know about the Von Erichs. I said, yeah, I'm a fan of World Class Championship Wrestling, and I'm a screenwriter. She goes, can you write a script? And I said, yeah, sure, I can write it. So this was back in 2013. And it took me about 5 weeks, wrote a script. It was a good script. And gave it to Lisa. And Lisa had kind of, she'd kind of misrepresented herself. I thought she had more contacts than she did. So I wrote the script. I like Lisa, and there's a sad ending to that story that I'll get to. I like Lisa, but I never completely trusted Lisa. So I started building a back door with Steve Cox, because Steve Cox, I knew before the whole Von Erich script, we just found each other on Facebook. But I said, Steve called me one day and he said, you wrote the script, Steve. By the way, everybody, there's so many Steves in my stories that it gets kind of confusing after a while. We go by Steve G. Yeah, Steve, it's again. So Steve said to me, you wrote the script, talk ahead with it. And I said, money? And he goes, money, is that all? I said, yeah. And he goes, I got these Tulsa wrestling. I got these Tulsa multimillionaire oil people, big wrestling fans, and they would like to get involved and finance it. And I said, that's really cool, Steve. I said, okay. So he goes, yeah, let me call these people, Schwab family. There were like five Schwab brothers. I lost track of which Schwab was which. Nothing to do with Charles Schwab Financial, by the way. Anyways, they were very interested. But of course, they asked the first question to Steve that I knew they would. They said, Steve, do we really need Lisa and Steve involved with this production? You know, because Hollywood, you know, everybody stabs you in the back. But Steve Cox, who's a stand-up guy, well, look, we don't really need Lisa because she's a little flaky, but it was her idea. But we do need Steve because he wrote the script and he'll keep Lisa in line. So I said, okay, fine. And then Lisa made a mistake. She started getting involved in promoting the Ross and Marshall, Kevin's sons, and bringing at the time, she actually got them on TNA, you know, on Slammiversary, one of those there. So she was booking them, but she was in over her head because she was a woman in a male testosterone-driven business, and she really didn't know, as the great late Lou Albano used to say, she didn't really know a wrist lock from a wristwatch. And I said to Lisa, you know, You got to be careful. You're dealing with like wrestlers now. You don't want to jeopardize the film. And then she started promoting a few local shows in Texas because she was in Dallas. And then I heard through back channels that she was pocketing some of the money. And I said, Lisa, I said, you're jeopardizing a $20, $25 million film over a couple hundred bucks. You know, money's tight. I understand that. But it's getting back to me what you're doing. And I said, number one, you always pay the boys first. And the boys are Ross and Marshall. Those are Kevin's sons. You pissed Kevin off. You don't want to piss him off. And I said, what else are you doing you shouldn't be doing? I said, you're not hitting on Kevin. He's happily married. I mean, Lisa was kind of attractive, you know, blonde. And we had never met. So Steve Cox was the only person I really trusted. But we were trying to bring Kevin into the 21st century, get him on Facebook, get him on, you know, how to use social media. Kevin was still living in the 1980s. And Kevin's an interesting guy. He's got a lot of bitterness and he doesn't trust easily. And I said, Lisa, do not jeopardize all this stuff. And she said, no, we're good, we're good. And, you know, I'm in L.A. at the time. She's in Dallas. Kevin is in Hawaii. Steve Cox is in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We're all spread out across the country. We're not even in the mainland altogether. And I kind of felt a little helpless. But so anyways, you know, we were she started a Facebook group page on the Von Erichs for the movie, the Von Erichs, the movie. And I juiced it up to 52,000 people. You know, but you got to be careful because I'm a good communicator. And Lisa was getting on there having fights with fans. And they said, Lisa, she was threatening to bring Kevin in to reprimand them like he was the dad. I said, Lisa, let me just run the page. I'll post a couple once in the morning, once in the evening. I'll do a Saturday night YouTube video. I'll find a good match and they'll be happy. It was like I taught inner city high school. It was like running my own classroom. And as Steve Cox explained to me, he goes, look, when people know you're going to have a film on the Von Erich family, everybody and their brother is going to come to you with their hand out. But if they don't have anything to bring to the table, you just say, yeah, I'll get back to you. You know, I can't use you right now. Lisa wanted to, like, repay her favors to everybody. And I thought maybe she was going to push me under the bus. You know, I was the screenwriter. And she goes, well, didn't you put my name on the script? I said, you didn't write the script, Lisa. She goes, well, what do I do? I said, you'll be an executive producer. The Schwab family is going to finance the film. You'll both have executive producer credit. I'll be the writer, and we'll work with them on future projects because they did have, even though they were in Oklahoma, they had a guy in Hollywood. They had a little, you know, studio, whatever, like a production company, not a studio. And again, we're all in different places. So I believe it was 5 years ago, actually right around this time, I had text Lisa. And I remember because it was the anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, November 22nd. And I text her and I said, Lisa, everything okay? Because I'm hearing things. And she said, everything's okay. That's the last time I heard it from Lisa. 3 weeks later, 2 weeks later, December 7th, and this is where the story gets weird, John. She disappeared, and nobody knows what happened. Until 3 weeks later, December 30th, it was the day before New Year's Eve. I remember that. I believe it was 2015. They found her body in the trunk of her son's Mustang in a motel on the wrong side of Dallas.
Whoa.
Yeah, I know. It gets weird. And it's still an unsolved crime. I have a friend who has two brothers who are Texas Rangers. This is how I got involved with people in Dallas. And it's still an unsolved case. Now, what happened to her is open to conjecture. Von Erich fans are thinking it was a random serial killer. It wasn't a random serial killer, John. It was deliberate, and it was to send a message. So you can understand how I was nervous at this point. A, I had people calling me saying, do you know what happened to her? No, I don't know what happened to her, and I don't think I'm ever going to know what happened to her. And most importantly, I have nothing to do with this, okay? I was in L.A. all this time. For about the next month, I was walking around, you know, looking over my shoulder. Steve Cox, who is a real tough guy himself, yeah, he was sitting on the front porch in Tulsa, with guns and ammo up his butt, wondering what was going on, too, because we didn't know what Lisa had said or what Lisa had done. And, but eventually nothing ever came of it. I did have a reporter in Dallas call me, you know, wanting to do a story. And I said, nah, you're just going to drag her name through the mud. She's dead. Obviously, she did something wrong. I have no idea what it was. And, you know, what can we do? Yeah, there's nothing to do about it. So everybody pulled back at that point from the production. I mean, we weren't actually in production yet. We were putting it, the Schwabs were interested, the Schwab brothers. Script is copyrighted to me, and I've renewed it 5 years later. And I do have an entertainment attorney in Los Angeles. And, and if we can get it made, we'd like to get it made because it's not a documentary. It's a feature. And it's a tragic story. But from a thematic standpoint, it's a great story. It's Shakespearean. A father was a world champ, had six sons, five died before their time, three by suicide. You know, Kevin wanted to tell the story, but everybody pulled back. And to tell you the truth, the film can get made without Kevin's permission because it really is public domain at this point. But everybody thought her death was like the curse of the Von Erichs. You know, that it was, I don't believe in curses or supernatural, but it is weird how this happened. But I figure Lisa dug a hole for herself. It was probably over money. And, I don't know what happened to her. And it did stop everything because I really thought this movie would have been made 5 years ago. It's still sitting there and it's my script and my entertainment attorney has it. And we'll see what happens this year with it again while I'm pushing some other things.
I'm just going to go back for a minute and ask, did you have to answer any questions with the police?
I was waiting. That's a good question. I was waiting for Dallas PD to call me, and they never did. I'm not hard to find. I'm pretty much out there on Facebook, and I'm not hiding from anybody. Except for that Dallas reporter, no. I mean, I do have a friend whose brothers are Texas Rangers, and two brothers are Texas Rangers, and he knew the Von Erichs he grew up with, and he said, he said they'll get a hold of you if they want to get a hold of you, but you were in Los Angeles, you don't know anything, and they never followed up on it. It's still an open case as far as I know. Kevin asked me not to post any more on it after this happened. I left it alone. It's still there. Technically, Lisa's the administrator on the page, and you can't even shut the page down if I wanted to, because you need a death certificate from the person who opened it up. And it's like, I'm not looking to get a death certificate from Lisa. I wouldn't even know how to do that anyways. It's just considered a tragic, unsolved mystery crime.
I'm going to interrupt my conversation with Steve for just one moment to talk to you about World's Greatest Comics. It's the one-stop shop for all your comic book-related needs. They've got single issues, graphic novels, collections, toys, collectibles, back issues, posters, comic book supplies. They've got it all. And if you want to make sure you never miss a single issue of your favorite comic, sign up for their pull system, and every time the book comes into the store, they'll hold a copy for you at the register till you come by and pick it up. If you're in the Central Ohio area, just swing on by the store. They're located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio. Or you could check them out online. WGComics.com is their website, and they're even on Facebook. Just look for @WGComics. And if you stop by World's Greatest Comics, let them know that you heard about the store from me, John Orlando, on the PVD cast. You mentioned a little bit about that Kevin seems to be a little bit bitter or maybe a little bit untrustworthy. What was the working relationship like with him? Because I assume had to touch base with him here and there. Okay. Like, how was he receptive to you?
Well, we did a lot of telephone conferences, and this was before people did Zoom. And, we were on the phone. We had myself and Lisa, Kevin, Steve Cox was on there. Probably Ross and Marshall would pop in. Kevin was the high flyer out of the brothers, if you remember. So he took a lot of he's had like 35 concussions. His memory is not what it used to be. His wife, Pam, his high school sweetheart, would jog his memory on the phone. So sometimes Kevin would, I don't want to make it sound like he has dementia or anything. He doesn't. But again, everybody connected to the Von Erichs lives in the past. For them, 1984, never really ended. And, Kevin would, he has a lot of bitterness. There was a time where Bob Guccione, he used to be the publisher of Penthouse. He did a big story on the Von Erichs, and I guess he kind of you know, he kind of slammed the family and blamed the father and everything. And there was a lot of cocaine issues. I mean, you know, Kerry was hooked on painkillers and things. He lost half his foot in a motorcycle accident. That's an interesting story if you want to talk about. But Kevin, you know, he would be paranoid. He would be bitter. You know, it's sort of – but sometimes he would snap into the old Kevin Von Erich when we were on the calls. He just but sometimes you felt like you were talking to somebody's father and you were just trying to say, you know, Kevin, you're Kevin Von Erich. Act like Kevin Von Erich. You know, he doesn't like – he hates Vince McMahon. He blames Vince for Kerry's death. You know, when Kerry was brought into the WWF, he was already past his prime. He had had his motorcycle accident. But Kerry got a little – well, number one, Vince changed the name to the Texas Tornado. He just erased the Von Erich history. You know, he gave Kerry a little push with the IC title where he beat Mr. Perfect, Curt Hennig, another sad story, Curt Hennig. And then Kerry lost it back to Curt a couple months later. And Kerry's push was over at that point. And, yeah, he hung around for a couple years in the WWF with his fringe, you know, Texas Tornado outfit. But Kevin says Vince gave him, like, enough cocaine and hookers just to keep him satisfied. And Kevin never forgave Vince for that. Kevin has a lot of grudges against a lot of people. When Lisa died, he just kind of pulled back from everything. I said, you know, it's not my fault. I mean, you know, nobody else blamed me because, you know, I said, look, I was in L.A. I wrote a script. I was doing the best I could to keep everything together. And, you know, I'm sorry things went south. It is what it is. And I don't know. I mean, I used to keep in touch with Kevin up until 2 years ago, wish him a happy birthday. I haven't heard from Kevin in 2 years. And to tell you the truth, you know, I just think at the end of the day, Kevin wanted to push his sons, Ross and Marshall. They had a tryout with WWE NXT for a while. They never made it. You know, they wrestle around the country. They wrestle in Japan. I don't think they haven't become big names or anything in either AEW or WWE, and I don't see that happening. Kevin wanted to make the film because he wanted to tell the truth, and he wanted to push his two sons' career as a tag team. And he did come out of the woodwork, Kevin, and he made a couple appearances with them. You know, it's almost like you're dealing with a family had a lot of tragedy. I mean, five brothers died. The oldest son, Jack Adkison Jr., Adkison is the real name, he was electrocuted when he was 6 years old when Fritz was working for Stu Hart's promotion up in Canada. It was in a trailer park. That was the first death. And then David in 84. And then within a six-year period, first Mike, then Kerry, then Chris. And at the end of the day, you're down to just Kevin, who, you know, he married his high school sweetheart, had four children, two sons in the business, but it must be a lot to live with to be Kevin Von Erich. I have no bad feelings towards Kevin. If I get my attorney to push the script to the right people, I would call Kevin again and see if he wants to get involved. But to tell you the truth, John, I don't know what he would say at this point. You know, it's just a lot of water's gone under the bridge.
You know, one other thing, too, that I think that some people overlook is not only were the Von Erichs involved in horrible tragedy, but you look at all the other individuals. Gina Hernandez died. Jeep Swedson, Bruiser Brody. I mean, there's a lot.
Chris Adams, one of my favorites.
Yeah, yeah, Chris Adams as well. I mean, that's there you go. That's how sad it is. I can't remember everybody who died. That's how long the list is.
Yeah.
World class. And that's going to wear not only on the fans, but also on the survivors, so to speak.
Sure. I mean, there's still a few left from the old days besides Kevin. Iceman King Parsons is, you know, I was a big Iceman fan. He made it through. But, yeah, it's just so many of them are gone. The Von Erichs, the non-Erichs. It really, and then, you know, you get all these crazy fans. And, you know, they're not all crazy, but too many of them just – they could sit and watch old shows from the 1980s of the Von Erichs, and even before they had the syndication contract, the old shows that played in Dallas, and they're content to live in that. They have no use for any other wrestling. They just think that, you know, these were the greatest wrestling family ever. They were a terrific wrestling family, but, you know, it has a very tragic end to it.
Steve, you mentioned that you liked Iceman King Parsons. So obviously, yeah, you're a wrestling fan. You've mentioned that. So who are some of the other favorites?
In world class or just overall we're talking about here?
We can go
world class. I guess I was a big Kevin was my favorite brother. I was a big Gentleman Chris Adams fan, and that tag team he had with Gino, the handsome half-breed Hernandez, the dynamic duo, they were a good tag team, really good. And Iceman Parsons. I mean, I grew up, you know, back east with Bruno Sammartino, Killer Kowalski, Victor Rivera. I didn't know about the rest of the wrestling world until the magazines I started buying as a kid. Then you find out about Ric Flair in the NWA, Vern Gagne and Nick Bockwinkel in the AWA, and Japan and Mexico. I grew up, I was a little kid with Bruno Sammartino. But yeah, I just thought world class was, they had great wrestlers, they had great storylines. And and I'm not one of these guys who lives in the past, but I watch WWE, but the storylines are terrible. Everything's geared towards a 12-year-old. I'm getting into AEW. I think AEW has a lot of promise. It's kind of like a retread of the old WCW from the 1990s, but I like it, and they're bringing back a lot of the old guys. You'll see Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard, Jake the Snake Roberts, but they've got a lot of talent. Chris Jericho is probably a little past his prime. But, John Moxley, Cody Rhodes, I like AEW. Ring of Honor looks like it's on life support right now, and that's too bad. I get Hollywood Wrestling, David Marquez's organization, on my local channel. And, you know, those guys look like they weigh $175. You know, so it's, I've had this conversation with Steve Cox, John, and I always said the best part of wrestling when I was a kid growing up, it wasn't the matches. The matches were fine, but, you know, and the athletes today are great. Some of them can do things in the ring that they couldn't have done 40 years ago. But I said, I miss the switch. I miss when the baby face became a heel in the middle of a match or the interview, or the heel became a baby face because he saved somebody in the ring. I said, you don't see that anymore. You get a guy like CM Punk, who's gone back and forth from babyface to heel 28 times, and it just has no emotional investment. Wrestling was only half the game. You had to be good on the mic. And there were guys who were terrific on the mic. Ric Flair, Dusty Rhodes, Roddy Piper. And, you know, a guy like Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, he took his – when he first came into the ring as babyface Rock, but then he turned into the heel, the arched eyebrow, and next thing you know, he's the number one – he leaves wrestling, and he's the number one movie star in the world. So there's just not a lot of good actors in the game. Vince, I mean, for him, the real money is in the merchandising. I mean, ratings on Raw have gone down so badly that I hear USA is threatening to cancel the show, which would, you know, really be a big shock. Yeah, it's just, it's a different, and I don't blame Vince because he made billions of dollars. By the way, I don't trust Vince because he came after us on the Von Erich film. Vince actually, he gave Kevin a job with Michael Hayes where they were on one of the WWE Demand, where they were introducing matches. For 5 years, Vince had the rights to the Von Erich story. He didn't do anything with it. I think he had it from like 2007 to 2012. And then we came along in 2013 where the rights had already lapsed, and Kevin knew that. And then when Vince heard, now this is kind of flattering that Vince McMahon hears about you, but then he wanted to take it back from us. And by this point, Kevin didn't like Vince at all. He pretty much hated Vince. And the rights had lapsed, and Vince didn't do anything with it. And what was Vince going to do? He wasn't going to make a real movie about the Von Erichs. He did a documentary, which was well-received. There's been a couple well-received Von Erich documentaries. So there's really – I mean, when I first met Lisa, she said, what kind of film are you going to write, another documentary? And I said, no, they've already done two well-received documentaries. We're going to do a feature on the family here because it's a Shakespearean tragedy. You know who Gregory Wyden is, W-I-D-E-N?
No.
Yeah, the Highlander movies, you know, and TV series, which I love, you know, with the chopping the heads off. In the end, there can be only one, the Immortals. Vince McMahon and he got a hold of Gregory Wyden, and he was trying to take back the rights to the film by hooking Gregory Wyden up with Kevin Von Erich. By this point, I had already written the script, and we were going to move into production. So I happened to watch the second Highlander movie, and the Freebirds were in it in the opening scene. I don't know if you're a Highlander fan. I was.
I remember that.
So in the opening scene for Highlander 2, which was actually a lousy movie, the three Freebirds, Michael P.S. Hayes, Terry Gordy, and Buddy Roberts, a wrestling group. And I got a hold of Kevin, and I called him, and I said, Kevin, you know, Gregory Wyden was involved with Michael Hayes, who's working for Vince McMahon and is representing Vince McMahon. And Vince is trying to get the rights to the story back. Thought you should know that. Kevin was like, I don't want anything to do with these people, Steve. Okay, I want nothing to do with Vince. Thanks for telling me. We're going to stick with what we're doing with you. I said, great. So, I heard Vince McMahon even offered Lisa a job up in Stamford, Connecticut. I said, he's trying to buy you off, Lisa. And she goes, really? I go, yeah, he's trying to buy you off. You know, and so we did go up against Vince, and, you know, Kevin never gave the rights to Vince again. I mean, he had a 5-year window. He didn't do anything with it. And what was he going to do with it? Vince McMahon has never he's never produced a serious wrestling movie. I mean, people say Vince McMahon destroyed wrestling. My feeling is he made wrestling mainstream. The Rock and Wrestling Connection. Now, all of a sudden, everybody knew what wrestling was. Hulk Hogan, Cyndi Lauper. You know, it's a different animal now. I do miss the territory days, John, where on a Saturday you could flip your remote, just channel surf, and you could find wrestling from L.A., from everywhere, all across the country. It was kind of cool. It's not gone. They still have territories and independent wrestling. But unless you have a TV contract, you're not going to make any money, and you're not going to go anywhere. So he did change the landscape of professional wrestling. But you know what? It was always entertainment. Yeah, kayfabe is dead. He made sure of that, Vince. When the Iron Sheik and Hacksaw Jim Duggan got arrested smoking pot in the backseat of a car, and they were mortal enemies at the time, that's when kayfabe died. But Vince was okay with that because it took the pressure off. We're not a sport. We're sports entertainment. It changed everything. But, you know, there's a lot of money in wrestling. Everybody wants to do what The Rock did, you know, become big time. There, you know, Roddy Piper, one of my favorites, God rest his soul. He did he was the first guy to really transition from Hollywood, from wrestling to Hollywood. And a lot of his stuff, other than They Live, which was a big movie, big Hollywood movie, a lot of his stuff went direct to video. And, you know, a lot of other guys haven't made it big yet. Steve Austin tried, made a few movies, never made big time. And John Cena might be the next guy who transitions. The next Fast and the Furious, he plays the heavy in it. He plays Vin Diesel's brother, which they look nothing alike, but, you know, what, so be it. I'm okay with that because wrestling is entertainment. It's part of Hollywood now. It's just not like it used to be. That's okay. I mean, I miss the territory days like everybody else, but, you know, I miss World Class, which was great. I'm a writer. I miss good storylines. I mean, wrestling at its best was a unique hybrid, and you just don't see the soap opera storylines continued from week to week anymore. That was the great thing. When you watched World Class, you remember they had feuds. When Chris Adams was Karen Von Erich's best friend, and then he turned on him, he was his mortal enemy. That was great, and that would be continued for months, you know, for a year. You know, you can only watch so much wrestling in the ring. At some point, you have to have betrayal and friendship and mic work, which is why a guy like Brock Lesnar has Paul Heyman doing all the talking for him. Yes, that's kind of what he's doing for Roman Reigns right now. It's a different animal, but it's a multi-billion dollar industry, and some of these guys will make it to Hollywood, whether they become as successful as The Rock. I don't know who the next superstar is going to be, but The Rock's still handling things very well. I think John Cena probably has the next best chance of being the next big wrestling superstar to transition into film. I like John Cena.
Yeah, he certainly has earned a lot of respect, I think, through his, you know, work ethic and his charity work. I mean, the guy's always giving back to the community, and, you know, he's the modern day Hulk Hogan.
You took the words right out of my mouth. Yeah, John Cena, and he can do comedy and drama, which like The Rock can do that. I mean, Dwayne Johnson, he's done some good comedies and he's made some good action films. John Cena, and he's got an interesting look. Yeah, I got a lot of use for John Cena, you know, but not everybody's going to make the transition. Randy Orton is not going to be an acting star. Steve Austin had his heart attack, and he never really made it he did low-budget movies. But, you know, it's interesting to see who some of these – I mean, you can tell who's good on the mic in wrestling if they can transition acting. But in my mind, Roddy Piper, Dwayne Johnson, possibly John Cena – you know, guys like Ric Flair never made it in the movies as good as they were on the mic. Dusty Rhodes, you know, never made it in the movies. Mm-hmm. Hulk Hogan, yeah, Hulk is great. He might be the most influential wrestling star of the past half century, but he was always Hulk Hogan. He was always like a big cartoon. And, you know, probably the best movie role he ever had was in the Rocky movie where he played Thunderlips, you know. So, it's all merged together. It's all entertainment. And, all these wrestlers. I have a good friend who's a David Batchelor, kind of looks like Roman Reigns. Yeah, he's a big guy, he's a legitimate 6'10". He says, yeah, a lot of these guys are not legitimate 6'10s. But you'd be surprised, The Undertaker is really only about 6'8". Kane is, they're not that big. And, you know, he was doing some wrestling. He got into it a little late when he was already 30. And then, but he was getting a lot of movie roles. He was doing some stunt work in Dwayne Johnson's films. And he was, like, making a decision. He said to me one day, Steve, where do I go? He goes, I stick with the wrestling. I'm working with the Samoan, you know, group. And he goes, but I'm getting some Hollywood work that's making me money. A longer career sticking with Hollywood, okay? You're going to take less less bumps, less broken bones. And, you know, eventually, if you, you know, you're a big guy, 6'10", and you can make a good career out of that in Hollywood. But he's got the wrestling in his blood, and he's trying to juggle both. He went to Japan for a while. You know, when you're 6'10", they don't expect you to do high-flying maneuvers. You know, Vince will put a mask on you and turn you into a cartoon, probably make you more money than you ever did before. But you know, then he uses you up and he finds the next flavor of the month, the next big guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, Steve, let's start wrapping things up here. I want to ask, do you have some other upcoming projects in the works? I think you hinted that you had a few other scripts.
Yes, absolutely. I'm basically a comedy guy, which the irony is I end up doing a real life tragedy. But one thing they taught us in film school, writing is writing, John. You know, it's like they always say the joke is you're a writer when the check clears. So, I have a high concept animated movie that could be my Shrek. I'm trying to entice my entertainment attorney, and I'll be posting some. I'm a little kid, you know, because it's registered to me and everything, but it's the kind it could be a movie franchise. And I'm not a big animated guy. I was a big comic book guy growing up, DC, Marvel, Archies, all that. But it just struck me one day, a high concept animated film idea that I hadn't seen before, you know, no talking animals. But it was my Shrek, and I could see where a group of characters could age along the way. And then I started talking about the merchandising money, you know, the whatever they use as lunchboxes or stuffed animals or T-shirts. So I'm big on that. I'd like to push that one. And, right now my attorney has two. He has the Von Erich one for me and the high concept animated one. I'd like to see him push one of those. And always, you know, every writer, when you get a good break, the question you're always waiting for is for the producers to say, well, I have other stuff in my toolbox too that's already written. And I can write for hire. I'm doing some writing assignments for people, some script evaluations. You know, if somebody wants to pay me to write something, I'll write it. But I have my own scripts. Right now, Hollywood's still shut down. We're living in a Zoom virtual world at this point, John. But everybody's making plans for when this ends, and it will end in 2021. This year kind of put a lot of us behind the eight ball, you know, when the pandemic hit. And now, you know, we're trying to, you know, guys like Tom Cruise, who threw a tantrum, which was well-deserved on the set of Mission.
Oh, yeah. Agreed.
Possible. Yeah, but he's right. I mean, look, I'm not the biggest Tom Cruise fan in the world, but yeah, you know, everybody needs to follow COVID protocol right now, because he said, look, we're not going to get movies made. We got to feed people's families this. And yeah, I'm Tom Cruise and it's my movie. I mean, we've seen a lot of selfishness and stupidity this year from Americans, and downright ignorance. Dr. Fauci tells me wear a mask and we can get our lives back to normal in a certain amount of time with the vaccine, social distancing. Yeah, you know, everybody misses human contact, but nobody wants to end up on a ventilator and in a hospital where there's no room for you anyways right now. And, you know, I don't believe it's a hoax.
Well, Steve, do you have a website or some social media or whatnot where folks can keep tabs on you and all the
projects? Well, you know, I'm also living in the late 20th century. My Facebook, I got a big audience on Facebook, 5,000 people, another 1,000 people following me. I'm not doing much with my Twitter or my other stuff. So right now I have to do an IMDb, but Facebook is the best place to post anything about me. The link to this interview is, you know, post whatever you want on there. You know, I have to expand a little bit more, but Facebook's always been my go-to, basically. And I'm on Instagram. I just started an Instagram a couple months ago. I still don't use it for anything. So Facebook, look, everybody has my phone number and my Facebook. Yeah, I'm just, you know, if I'm not on Facebook, you know, people think I'm dead. But I have a lot of fun with that, and I don't have any privacy settings, so I like to keep it spontaneous, John. So sometimes some knuckleheads show up, I don't care. If they don't bother me too much, if they don't troll me, I let them stay. If they troll me, I make them disappear. It's a very nice function on Facebook. You can block people, and it's like they never existed. But yeah, I've got a really varied audience on there. You got pro wrestlers, Hollywood people, people I grew up with, USC, Brandeis, basically everybody I've known since the second grade. Then there's my family. It's amazing. I like Facebook. I mean, without Facebook, you know, I really would be out of touch right now with everybody. So that's kind of where people find me. And I got to do an IMDb, maybe get more involved with Twitter. Although from what I hear, Twitter sounds like more trouble than it's worth with a lot of people. You know, I don't want to argue. I'm at my core, I'm an entertainer. I'm funny. I like to make people laugh. I did teach inner city high school. I've got a lot of former students on there. I still like to educate and elucidate and entertain. But, I've gotten very professional at the getting rid of the arguments and just getting rid of the crazy people. Yeah, I'm sure you're on the same platform I am. You know what it's like.
Exactly.
And, look, it's been a rough year for everybody. Nerves are frayed. Tempers are short. I just try to entertain. I mean, we all have our own politics. I mean, I'm glad we're getting a new president, but I got friends who voted for Trump. I mean, as long as they don't go crazy on me. I mean, I don't like any racist or anti-Semitic stuff on my page. I put a stop to that. But, you know, the hate has to stop. But we can all agree to disagree. Used to be a time where we could agree to disagree. We're all American. Yep. It's kind of sad right now. But
exactly.
We can't do that. So, yeah. Yep. So I try to preach that when I can.
Well, Steve, it's been a blast. I really do appreciate you coming on. And definitely, folks, check out Steve's Facebook profile. And, Steve, thanks a lot, man.
Hey, John, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Post the link on it. And you're on my page. I'm on your page. We'll be talking again in the future.
You got it. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to throw it to a quick break. And on the other side of the break, I'll be back to wrap up the episode. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. My conversation with Steve Goldstein, talking about his screenplay, about the Von Erich family, and kind of talking about all things world-class championship wrestling. And before I go any further to let you know where you can get in touch with me if you have questions, concerns, or comments, I do want to just real quickly mention another podcast on this show. And I believe that I talked about this fine podcast of couple of years ago when I got a chance to meet the guys that put it on. I'm talking about the Lapsed Fan. Those guys, Jack and JP, did an amazing multi-episode podcast series on world-class championship wrestling. As a matter of fact, it's called The Lamentable Tragedy of World-Class Championship Wrestling. And those guys did a lot of research and presented a lot of interesting facts about not only the Von Erich family, but the other individuals in world-class wrestling and kind of the inner workings of WCCW. So if you are like me and you're a huge fan of WCCW, check out The Lapsed Fan. Just go over to any of your podcasting platforms and look for The Lapsed Fan Podcast, The Lamentable Tragedy of World-Class Championship Wrestling, and just give it a listen. So check out, again, The Lapsed Fan Podcast. I'm not afraid to put other podcasts over, especially if they're world class. See what I did there? I know that was terrible. That was a lame pun. What can I say? All right. Let me tell you where you can get in touch with me if you need to or you want to.
I'm on Twitter. My personal Twitter handle is at PVDMVP. You can leave me a message over on the Facebook or Instagram feeds of the PVDcast. Just look for at PVDcast. And of course, if you're old school, you can shoot me an email. The email address is johnorlando@pvdcast.com. This podcast is available a ton of different places, including pvdcast.com, the online home of yours truly, but it's also available through all those major podcasting platforms like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, iHeartRadio. Basically, go to your favorite podcasting platform, put in PVDcast. Sometimes you have to put my name after it into the search engine, and you should find it. Every week, there are two live broadcasts of the PVDcast. The first one on Monday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, through the Facebook page at PVDcast, where I have a live broadcast of the current week's episode. And you can add comments and we can interact a little bit. But if you miss the one on Monday night at 8, you can catch the Tuesday night replay, 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, on the Scene Snobs Network. Please check out www.thescenesnobs.com to find out about all of their great podcasts and things going on with that network. I'm very happy that they're distributing the PVDcast through the Scene Snobs Network. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to get on out of here. I thank you all for listening, and I will chat at each and every one of you later. Stay righteous, stay independent, stay safe and healthy. Production of John Orlando Enterprises, LLC, copyright 2020.